So the, I will now introduce the second speaker, Daniel Rueckert. So Daniel is the director of the Biomedical Image Analysis Group at Imperial College London, and he is a professor of visual information processing. He received a diploma in computer science from the Technical University Berlin and a PhD in computer science from Imperial College London. Before moving to Imperial College, he worked in the division of radiological sciences and medical engineering at King's College, still in London. Professor Rueckert is an associate editor of IEEE Transactions on Medical Imaging. He's a member of the editorial board of the Medical Image Analysis Journal and of Image and Vision Computing. He has served as a member of organizing and program committees at numerous conferences. He has been co-chair of FIMH 2013, as well as program co-chair of MICAI 2009.
Thank you very much for the kind introduction. It's really a great pleasure to be here. And what I would like to do in the next half an hour is give you an overview of an idea of how we can actually learn clinically useful information from medical images. And what I would like to do is I would like to take you through three different areas where we can use ideas from machine learning to actually significantly improve the way we actually deal with medical images. And then at the end, I would like to show you one clinical application, how we put all these three different ideas together and actually make them work in the clinical context. So the first thing I would like to do is actually show you an idea of how we can use machine learning to make the way we acquire our data actually better. And we call this concept intelligent imaging. And I want to give you a brief idea of how this works. So I guess most of you are quite familiar with how an MRI scanner looks like. You see one here. If you are a bit more familiar with this, you probably know that you can image very young subjects. You can image quite small and big subjects. If you don't like the color of your MRI scanner, you can also buy them in different colors, and you can also buy them in different shapes. But there's a fundamental limitation with how MRI data is actually acquired, which limits how it's working in practice. So if you think about MRI imaging, it's inherently a sequential serial process which acquires data. And that slow acquisition is actually quite okay if you're looking at a static object like the brain or some bones. But actually, it's much more problematic if we actually try to deal with data which is moving, for example, the heart or the liver due to respiration or the fetus. So our options in those cases where there's motion is to either acquire real-time MRI very fast, typically two-dimensional, with poor image quality, or we have to resort to some sort of gating techniques, which are useful for the heart or a respiratory motion, but they make the acquisition much, much longer. So both of them are not really ideal. However, what we really would like to do is we would like to look at an object like the heart you see here and actually really appreciate the fully dynamic nature of that data, because that tells us something very important, not only about the anatomy we're looking at, but also at the function of the anatomy, which of course is actually even more important. So how can we make this acquisition, which typically lasts 30 to 60 minutes if we do a comprehensive study, how can we make this faster? Well, so one idea is to actually look back to the image acquisition physics. And the image acquisition physics is not quite simple as it's shown here. And I realize there's a spelling mistake, so this should be Mike Brady's MRI design, of course. But actually, without going anywhere into the physics, we can actually look at some very simple mathematical relationship between the signals we acquire and what we want to reconstruct. So if we actually do MRI imaging, we actually acquire data in something which we call the K-space. We're effectively traversing line by line through this K-space, and that K-space is nothing else than the Fourier spectrum of the image. So we effectively acquire a Fourier transformed version of the image. And in order to take that data and convert it back into something we all know, an image we can observe, we simply apply the Fourier transform to go back to the image data. Now, if we want to do this with a heart, we want to do this with dynamic data, we're going to keep on doing the same process over and over again. And actually, we're acquiring quite a lot of redundant data in this process because the heart is, of course, only a small region which is moving, and the rest of the image is not changing that much. So how can we make that process faster? The process is slow because I have to go serially through every line here in this case space. Well, one way of making it faster is to simply undersample my data. And that undersampling is actually very easy to do. I'm just going to skip, for example, every second or third line in my case space. And instead of acquiring the full case space, which is denoted by this white area here, I'm going to acquire only a quarter of the data. And I'm going to do this in a random fashion. So I'm randomly sampling some lines of that case space, and some others I don't. And that makes the whole process faster. Here I have only 25%, so the acquisition is four times faster than it used to be before. But the downside is you actually get an image which has serious artifacts. There is serious aliasing in the data. So how can we recover from that limited amount of data the full image without actually sacrificing image quality? And in order to do this, we can use an idea from machine learning, which has been around for quite a while, and also from signal processing, which is based on sparsity. So the idea is that if we look at a normal data set, a medical image, for example, we all know that this is typically quite compressible. So if I apply a compression algorithm like a wavelet transform onto the data, I can compress the data into a relatively small number of coefficients which are non-zero, and I get a very sparse representation. On the other hand, if I have aliasing in my data, it turns out it becomes much harder to compress that signal because the aliasing is very incoherent, and therefore I need quite a lot of information to compress that, to encode that information. So actually, if I have aliased images, I have a much less sparse representation of the data. So using this basic premise from machine learning and signal processing, I can now formulate a new approach for how I can recover my image. And that's called compressed sensing. So the idea is we have an undersampled observation in our case space. So we haven't acquired all the data. We have our undersampled Fourier operator. And now we're trying to recover a new solution X, which is a full case space, such that it's consistent with what we have actually measured in case space. So I've acquired some data, and whatever I want to recover needs to be consistent with that bit of data. And at the same time, I would like to find the sparsest representation of the data which is possible. So I want to find an image which is easy to compress, which doesn't have any aliasing. And much of the work I'm going to show you in the following is actually devoted to how I can learn what is the sparsest representation from the data. So as I said before, one approach is you could simply use something like a wavelet transform, a generic compression algorithm. We're using actually something very specific called dictionary learning, where we learn directly from the data how we can encode the image in the sparsest way. And the basic premise of this algorithm is that we have a training stage which learns a dictionary, which you see here as a sort of, you can think of this as small building blocks from which I can reconstruct the image in a sparse fashion. Once I've learned this, I can encode my image using this dictionary, I can ensure data consistency, and I can iterate through this process and recover the full data. So let me just walk you briefly how this works. So the first stage is, how do we construct a dictionary? And that's actually fairly simple. I'm just going to take some patches through my sequence. I'm going to arrange all these patches as columns in a big matrix, and then I'm solving an optimization problem, where I try to find a dictionary, which is a matrix of these visual words, which multiplied with a sparse combination of coefficients gives me actually the data I want to reconstruct. So I'm solving this optimization problem. And by solving this optimization problem, I get a dictionary which looks like this. You can see that this dictionary is not static because I'm dealing with a Sine sequence, so I'm dealing with objects which move. So you can actually see that this dictionary consists of small patches, and if I stitch them together and combine them in a sparse fashion, I can recover the full MR image which I'm looking at. So once I've done this, I'm going to take that dictionary and I'm going to encode the entire sequence of images using this dictionary. And it turns out that if I do this, I can actually encode very well the image I want to recover, but I can't really encode very well the aliased artifact. So actually, this process almost acts like removing the aliases from the image. And finally, of course, I have measured some bits of K-space, so I know the true solution for those. And so whatever I have in my solution needs to be consistent with K-space data which I have measured. So if I have this consistency term, I can now close the loop and reconstruct the full data. So here's an example of what the final outcome of the algorithm is. What you see here in the top left, you see the original solution, fully sampled, everything acquired which I need. This is an image which I've created by undersampling this full solution by a factor of 8. So I'm 8 times faster than I used to be before, but you can see that the image is hardly recognizable in terms of quality. If I apply this dictionary learning algorithm, I can recover a near-perfect solution. This here is actually the error map, showing you the error between the original solution and what I recover, and you can see that the errors are very, very small. And what you see on the right is effectively our closest competitor from the world of compressed sensing. I can even push this further and actually undersample the data even more aggressively. You can see here a 12-fold undersampling, and you can see that effectively here in my original data, there's very little information if I just display the images like this. If I apply the dictionary learning, I can still recover an almost perfect solution. I now have some larger errors, which you can see here at the boundaries of the object, but I still have an image which is probably good enough for visual interpretation and also good enough to actually perform image analysis tasks on those. So this is a quite nice example of how I can actually use ideas from machine learning to make the acquisition of data faster. So in the second part of the talk, I want to show you an application of machine learning to image segmentation. And of course, I guess you all know image segmentation. It's one of the standard problems in medical image analysis. And one way of tackling this problem is to actually view this as a model matching or a registration problem. So if I have a model of my anatomy, which can be an atlas or something else, I can register that model onto a new image, and by doing so, I can propagate the labels or the information I have in my atlases onto my new image. And I can do this using a variety of algorithms. Here you see one example where I'm deforming one brain onto the configuration of another brain. This probably should be fine. Onto another brain. You can see this works reasonably well, and depending on what algorithms you use, you will obtain actually a quite reasonable looking segmentation. So I'm comparing here a manual segmentation with an automatic segmentation, and you can see that that actually does reasonably well. If you look into details, though, you will spot some errors. So this is not quite good enough for clinical use. So how can I make this better? So one way of doing this is to use ideas from machine learning again. let's assume I have an entire database of labeled brains. So if you imagine that you have an entire set of these labeled brains, I can use each brain in turn. I can register every brain onto my unseen data set. And for every atlas I perform this registration, I obtain a solution, a segmentation. Now, all of these solutions will be slightly different because I'm starting with a slightly different atlas. The registration is going to do some errors, but in an ideal world, I can make the assumption that the errors I obtain in those segmentations are hopefully uncorrelated. And if they're uncorrelated, then a lot of theory from machine learning tells us if I have uncorrelated classifiers, I can build a better classifier by combining the output of each classifier together. And so this process, which we call decision fusion, or in our case, label fusion, in its simplest form is actually very similar to the English election system. You simply do a majority vote. Whoever gets most votes wins the election. And that actually, if we do this in practice, and if we look at how well this performs, it is quite remarkable how quickly we improve our segmentation, which I've measured here in terms of the number of atlases on the horizontal axis, and on the vertical axis, the segmentation quality as measured by comparing to a gold standard. You can see we're actually doing very well. But again, we probably don't do quite well enough to actually be used in a clinical scenario. And there are several reasons for why we're not doing well enough. So one thing is, turns out that the more atlases we have, the better we will do. And getting a very large number of atlases is very, very costly because they have to be labeled by experts. So it's a very, very expensive process. And in addition, we have learned that the better I have customized my atlases to my population I want to study, the better this will work. So I can't just ask a clinician every time I want to label some images, say, actually, can you please build an atlas database for us? And finally, I need a registration, which can be very, very time-consuming if I have to repeat it 100 times. So I'm going to show you a very similar concept, dictionary learning now being applied for segmentation, in order to relax a requirement for having a large atlas database and a very accurate registration. And the idea is the following. If I want to segment this target image, I'm going to use a patch which I'm trying to label, the central pixel or voxel. And before I label that voxel, I'm going to take a number of patches within a window around the hypothesized location of that patch in my atlas database. I extract a library of these patches. And from this library and the labels for those patches, I can learn another dictionary. And again, that's in a very similar spirit to what we have done before, except that I'm now trying to use the same idea for segmentation. So once I've learned this dictionary, I can simply encode this target patch using my dictionary elements, and that will effectively produce a segmentation by fusing those labels together. So if you want to think of this in a mathematical framework, it will look pretty much like this. So I have my dictionary matrix here, which I combine in a sparse combination to form the patch to reconstruct all the patches in my dataset. Now it turns out that dictionaries are great for reconstruction, but they're not always very discriminative because they are just trained to reconstruct the data but not discriminate between the data. So one way of making this actually even better is we can actually add a very simple linear classification term to this dictionary elements. So instead of having a dictionary element which is just gray levels, we also have a linear classifier here which votes for a label. And during our atlas, during our dictionary learning, we learn this dictionary together with a classifier so that actually when we encode our patches, we get a segmentation for free. And actually it turns out if you, for example, apply this to brain images, and we've worked quite a lot with looking at the hippocampus in Alzheimer's disease. It actually works really well. So I've shown you a database here of 800 subjects, but I'm just showing you the best segmentation, the median, and the worst segmentation. So these are the reference subjects, the reference segmentations. And here is what the dictionary learning does. And you can see even in the worst case, so this is out of the 800 subjects, the worst segmentation. It actually does a pretty good job at segmenting the hippocampus, which is a small, difficult to localize structure, quite accurately. So actually, this is a quite powerful approach for segmenting images in a fully automatic way. Okay, so the final bit of methodology which I want to cover is something which we term a biomarker discovery. And again, I want to show you how machine learning can be used to try to extract directly from the images without an a priori hypothesis useful information from the images. And in order to do this, I first thought I should give you a basic idea of what the methodology is which I want to use. So I'm going to use something which in machine learning is called manifold learning. And for a lot of you, this might look very familiar to concepts like dimensionality reduction. I have, for example, on the left-hand side, a three-dimensional data set, and I want to reduce it into two dimensions without really distorting the geometric shape. So you see this, what's called here the Swiss roll, which is rolled up in itself, and I want to effectively unroll this structure into a lower dimensional manifold. And if you want to think of this in the context of images, you can think of this as the images not being embedded in three dimensions, but they will actually be embedded in a very high dimensional space, which is equivalent to the number of pixels or voxels you have in the images. But after you have uncovered the structure, you will find out that images which are very similar, like these face images, for example, should end up quite close together in the manifold, and images which look very dissimilar will actually end up quite far away from each other in the manifold. So how do I actually do this with medical images? Well, it actually turns out to be very simple. I take all my images, which I have, and in the first stage, I'm constructing a graph representation from the images. So in this graph representation, every image is a node in the graph, and the similarity between two images is encoded by the edge between those two nodes in my graph. So you can think of this as a similarity matrix. In the second step, I'm going to sparsify the graph. So I'm going to delete all the edges which don't belong to my nearest neighbors, because I don't really trust these edges that they represent useful information. So I end up with a sparse matrix W here. And then in the final step, I can perform a spectral analysis of this similarity matrix, which produces my manifold coordinates. And in order to actually understand what this does to a set of images, I've prepared this picture here, which shows you a database of 800 brain images. Around 200 of those subjects are normal subjects. 200 of those subjects are patients with Alzheimer's disease. And 400 subjects are at an intermediate stage. And you see the Alzheimer's subjects are the blue points, the normal subjects, the controls, are the red points. So you see that most of the blue points are on the left side of this manifold. The red points are mostly on the right side. But if I would ask you, can you find, for example, a plane which separates normals from Alzheimer's patients, you would probably say, no, that's not going to be possible. There is not enough separation. However, one thing we can do is we can look at information, temporal information. We can actually study how every subject, as a brain is aging, moves through this manifold. And suddenly we start to see a very clear pattern. The normal subjects, the red points, stay pretty much clustered on the right side and don't move very much. Whereas the patients, the blue points with Alzheimer's disease, they actually tend to move more and more to the left, and they move a quite considerable amount through this manifold. So even though I can't classify a single subject based on its manifold coordinates, if I look at the trajectory of the subject through the manifold, I can actually build a very good classifier and actually do a pretty good job with 88% of finding out which subject is which. Now, I have not segmented any of these images, so the images are effectively unprocessed raw signals which go in this analysis. So I can actually extract quite a lot of useful information from simply looking at the intensity patterns in the images using this manifold learning. I can basically let the machine learning figure out quite a lot of the structure in the data itself. So, in the final application, I want to show you how all these three different areas, image acquisition, image segmentation, and biomarker discovery, come together. And I want to give you an idea or an application which we work in our group quite a lot in, and that's really looking at how the brain is developing inside as a fetus, inside the mother, but also as a consequence of preterm birth. So we really would like to have a better way of looking at fetal abnormalities. We would like to understand better what are the causes of preterm birth and the consequences as well, so that we can improve neonatal intensive care, but also spot long-term problems much earlier than we can do otherwise. However, there are some very significant challenges in this, and these challenges are mostly due to the fact that the subjects we are scanning are very vulnerable. They are very small, so the fetus and, of course, a preterm brain is much smaller than the adult brain. And, of course, these subjects move in a way which we cannot control. So that makes actually the acquisition part very challenging. So this allows us to sort of bring all the three concepts which I showed earlier together into one single application. And really, to appreciate the challenge in imaging, I want to show you a very simple example of why the imaging of the fetus, for example, is so challenging. So when I scan the fetus inside the mother, there's, of course, a lot of a fetal motion going on, but also maternal motion. So the mother is breathing. The fetus is moving a lot during the scanning, predominantly because the scanner is very loud. So if the fetus is asleep, you can be sure the fetus will wake up when you do the scanning. So there's a tremendous amount of motion in the images. And you should really remember that the data we acquire, I'm showing you a 2D slice, and that's what we can image in real time. But we cannot really image in 3D in real time. So I'm ending up with quite a lot of data sets like this. If I would want to reconstruct a three-dimensional data set from this, I have the challenge that the fetal brain in the plane in which I have acquired the data set, in the 2D plane, will look reasonably good. But in 3D, in the other direction, it will look, of course, very much corrupted because I have this fetal motion. So I can't really do a volumetric analysis of the data like this. So we have been working on a number of different approaches for reconstructing a motion-free image set. And the way we do this at the moment is we acquire multiple sets of 2D slices in different directions. So I'm going to acquire one data set in an orientation like this, one in an orientation like this, and we're going to oversample, actually, our data set. Once we have done this, we're going to arbitrarily take one of these volumes as a reference, and we register all other volumes to this reference volume and form an initial hypothesis of how the data set can look like. And I should say that because we're looking at the brain, we can make the assumption that we only have rigid motion between the acquisitions. So the brain is only rotating and translating. So we'll end up with this initial volume here, but this is probably not good enough for analysis, because of course I might have also motion between every slice during my acquisition. So in the next step, I'm going to go through every slice and allow every slice to readjust and realign every slice to my hypothetical volume. I'm going to reconstruct a new volume and repeat this process until I converge. So this allows us to take this initial data set I showed you earlier and apply also ideas from super resolution to reconstruct using registration a much higher quality three-dimensional volume of the fetal brain in utero, and we can now start doing more clever things with volumetric analysis of this fetal brain. So the pipeline we have at the moment is we acquire our data in these multiple cine loops, we perform the reconstruction I've just shown you, and then we can also do our multi-atlas segmentation, which I also showed you earlier. So we're going to take actually multiple neonatal atlases, which we have generated with our clinical collaborators. So we have an entire database of these neonatal brains. We register them on our new image, and we can now start for the first time to look at the fetal brain. So this is a brain, different ages during gestation, from a very young brain to a much older brain. And we can automatically find different structures in the brain and label them completely automatically. Because we also have these data sets acquired in 3D, we can, of course, also now look at the 3D anatomy, study the 3D volumes and shapes of all those brain structures in quite a lot of detail. So this tells you quite a lot about a single subject, how a single subject is growing. But one challenge which I want to finish off with is, how do we actually take this further and study how a whole population of subjects is growing? And as I said, I showed you this idea of manifold learning beforehand. We're going to use a very similar idea to actually now study, try to uncover the average growth trajectory of brain development by using, of course, instead of adult brains, now neonatal brains, but performing a very similar manifold analysis to what I've shown you before, except that we measure similarity between our data sets with two different components. We look at similarity in terms of shape and similarity in terms of appearance, which allows us to take a database like these brains here and rearrange all these brains in such a way that they are mapped onto the manifold according to shape and appearance similarity. And if I add to that manifold clinical information, for example, like the ages of the subjects, which are color-coded in this map here. So these two maps showing exactly the same thing. In one case, I'm representing every subject by a colored dot according to the age of the subject. I can now compute the average regression curve with time and basically trace out that trajectory in a very similar fashion, and try to work out what is the average brain configuration as I move along this aging trajectory. And this is what you see here. So this is a spatiotemporal atlas of the developing brain from 28 weeks to 44 weeks. So this is just after birth, and this is probably a very early time point for preterm birth. And what you see on this slide is not actually a single subject, but it's an average of 200 subjects, which are weighted according to their temporal, according to their age. And this, for the first time, allows you to actually build a sort of normative map of brain development and actually try to identify what might go wrong in premature birth. So I just wanted to, at the end, acknowledge all the colleagues which have contributed to this work. So this is a quite big collaborative effort, which has led to all the images I've shown you here. especially from our clinical collaborators who have spent a lot of time acquiring their data. And finally, I should also thank all these funding bodies for funding the work I've shown you here today. Thank you very much.